floor level by drain holes for rainwater, and she managed to get her hand into one and grab the edge. He kicked her arm, and she lost her grip. He managed to pull her until she was half over the edge. She was face down and staring at the drop, screaming in mortal terror. He released her collar and tried to grab her ankles so that he could tip her over. He got hold of one ankle, but could not grasp the other. He lifted her foot as high as he could. She was almost over now, clinging to the top of the wall with both hands. He grasped one arm and pulled her hand off the wall. She tipped over, but grabbed his wrist at the last minute. He almost went over the side with her, but her strength failed her, and she released him. For a moment, he teetered, windmilling his arms. Then he was able to step back to safety. She overbalanced in the other direction and tilted, with nightmare slowness, off the parapet. He watched, with a mixture of triumph and horror, as she fell slowly through the air, turning over and over, her screams a faint cry in the wind. He heard the thud as she hit the roof of the choir. She bounced and came down again with her head at a queer angle, and he guessed her neck was broken. She rolled limply down the slope of the roof and off the edge, struck the top of a flying buttress, fell to the lean-to roof of the north aisle, tumbled off its edge, and at last came to rest, a lifeless bundle, in the graveyard. There was no one in the graveyard. Rollo looked in the opposite direction, but he saw nothing but rooftops. Nobody had seen the fight. He stepped through the low doorway, closed the door behind him, and went down the steep spiral staircase as fast as he could. He stumbled twice and almost fell, but he had to hurry. Reaching the bottom, he stopped and listened at the door. He could hear nothing. He opened the door a crack. He heard no voices, no footsteps. He peeped out. The cathedral seemed empty. He stepped into the transept and closed the door behind him. He hurried along the south aisle, raising the hood of his cloak. He reached the west end of the church and cracked the door. There were people in the market square, but no one was looking his way. He stepped outside. Without pausing, he walked south, past the entrance to the indoor market, deliberately not looking around him. He did not want to meet anyone's eye. He turned around the back of the bishop's palace and made his way to the main street. It crossed his mind to leave town instantly and never come back. But several people knew he was here, and that he was planning to leave in the morning with a group of travellers, so if he now left precipitately, it would be sure to throw suspicion on him. The town watch might even send horsemen to catch up with him and bring him back. He would do better to remain, and act innocent. He turned toward the market square. The play had ended and the crowd was coming out of the bell courtyard. He spotted Richard Grimes, a prosperous Kingsbridge builder who sat on the borough council. "Good afternoon, Alderman," he said politely. Grimes would remember that he had seen Rollo coming up the main street from the direction of the riverside, apparently having been nowhere near the cathedral. Grimes was surprised to see him after so many years, and was about to start a conversation when they both heard cries of shock and dismay coming from the graveyard. Grimes went in the direction of the hubbub, and Rollo followed. A crowd was gathering around the body. Sylvie lay with arms and legs visibly broken, and one side of her head a horrible mass of blood. Someone knelt beside her and felt for a heartbeat, but it was obvious that she was dead. Alderman Grimes pushed through the press of people and said, "That's Sylvie Willard. How did this happen?" "She fell from the roof." The speaker was Susan White, an old flame of Rollo's, once a pretty girl with a heart-shaped face, now a grey-haired matron in her 50s. Grimes asked her, "Did you see her fall?" Rollo tensed. He had been sure no one was watching, but if Susan had glanced up, she would probably have recognized him. Susan said, "No, I didn't see, but it's obvious, isn't it?" The crowd parted, and Ned Willard appeared. He stared at the body on the ground for an instant, then roared like a wounded bull. "No." He fell to his knees beside Sylvie. Gently, he lifted her head and saw that part of her face was pulp. He began to weep then, still saying, "No, no." But quietly, between sobs that came from deep inside. Grimes looked around. "Did anyone see her fall?" Rollo got ready to make a run for it, but no one spoke. The murder had not been witnessed. He had got away with it. Marjorie stood at Sylvie's graveside as the coffin was lowered into the ground. The day was still and cold, with a feeble winter sun breaking through clouds intermittently, but Marjorie felt as if she were in a tornado. Marjorie was heartbroken for Ned. He was weeping into a handkerchief, unable to speak. Barney stood on his right, Alpha on his left. Marjorie knew Ned, and she knew that he had loved Sylvie with all his being. He had lost his soulmate. No one knew why Sylvie had chosen to climb the tower. Marjorie knew that her brother Rollo had been in town that day, and it crossed her mind that he might be able to answer the question, but he had left the day after. Marjorie had casually asked several people whether they had seen Rollo before he left, and three of them had said something like, "Yes, at the play, he was standing near me." Ned said that Sylvie had always wanted to see the view from the tower, and perhaps she had disliked the play and had chosen that moment to fulfill her wish, and on balance, Marjorie thought that was the likeliest explanation. Marjorie's sorrow for Ned was made even more agonizing by this knowledge, that the tragedy might, in the end, bring her what she had craved for the last 30 years. She felt deeply ashamed of the thought, but she could not blind herself to the fact that Ned was now a single man, and free to marry her. But even if that happened, would it end her torment? She would have a secret that she could not reveal to Ned. If she betrayed Rollo, she would be condemning her sons. Would she keep the secret and deceive the man she loved? Or would she see her children hanged? As the prayers were said over the broken body of Sylvie, Marjorie asked God never to force her to choose. It was an amputation. I would never get back the part of me that vanished when Sylvie died. I knew the feeling of a man who tries to walk, having lost a leg. I would never shake off the sense that something should be there, where the missing limb had always been. There was a hole in my life, a great gaping cavity that could never be filled. But the dead live on in our imaginations. I think that's the true meaning of ghosts. Sylvie was gone from this earth, but I saw her every day in my mind. I heard her, too. She would warn me against an untrustworthy colleague, mock me when I admired the shape of a young woman, laugh with me at a pompous alderman, and cry over the illness of a child. In time, the hurricane of grief and rage abated, and I was possessed by a calm, sad resignation. Marjorie came back into my life like an old friend returned from overseas. That summer she came to London and moved into Shiring House in the Strand, and soon I was seeing her every day. I learned the meaning of the word bittersweet, the acid taste of loss, and the honey of hope in one bright fruit. We saw plays. We rode horses in the Westminster fields, we took river trips and picnicked in Richmond, and we made love, sometimes in the morning, sometimes in the afternoon, sometimes at night, occasionally all three. Walsingham was suspicious of her at first, but she disarmed him with a combination of flirtatiousness and intellect that he found irresistible. In the autumn, the ghost of Sylvie told me to marry Marjorie. "Of course I don't mind," she said. "I had your love while I was alive. Marjorie can have it now. I just want to look down from heaven and see you happy." We were married in Kingsbridge Cathedral at Christmas, almost a year after Sylvie died. It was a subdued ceremony. Weddings are usually about young people starting out in life, but ours seemed more like an ending. Walsingham and I had saved Queen Elizabeth and fought for her ideal of religious freedom. Barney and I, and the English sailors, had defeated the Spanish Armada, and Marjorie and I were together at last. It seemed to me that all the threads of our lives had drawn together. But I was wrong. It was not over yet. Not quite. Part 5. 1602 to 1606. Chapter 28. Rollo Fitzgerald lived through the last decade of the 16th century in a fury of disappointment and frustration. Everything he had tried to do had come to nothing. England was more resolutely Protestant than ever. His life was a failure. And then, with the turn of the century, he perceived that there was one last hope. Queen Elizabeth was 66 when the new century began. It was a great age, and she was becoming haggard, pale, and melancholy. She refused to look to the future and made it an act of treason to even discuss the question of who would succeed to her throne. "Men always worship the rising rather than the setting sun," she said, and she was not wrong. Despite her prohibition, everyone was talking about what would happen when she died. Late in the summer of 1602, a visitor from Rome came to see Rollo at Tyne Castle. It was Lenny Price, who had been a student with Rollo at the English College back in the 70s. The lively, pink-faced youth of those days was now a grey-haired man of 55. "The church has a mission for you," said Lenny. "We want you to go to Edinburgh." They were standing on the roof of one of the castle towers, looking across farmland to the North Sea. Rollo's pulse quickened at Lenny's words. Scotland was ruled by King James VI, the son of Mary Stuart. "Mission?" he said. "Queen Elizabeth has no heir," Lenny said. "None of the three children of Henry VIII ever had a child, so King James is the likeliest candidate to succeed Elizabeth on the throne of England." Rollo nodded. "He's had a book published explaining his right to the throne." James believed in the power of the written word, a useful philosophy for the king of a small, poor country such as Scotland. "He's clearly manoeuvring for it. He's seeking support. So Rome thinks this is the moment to extract promises from him." Rollo felt a warm surge of hope, but forced himself to be realistic. "Despite his mother, James is no Catholic. He was taken from Mary Stuart when he was a year old, and from then on the poison of Protestantism was dripped daily into his childish ear." "But there's something you don't know," said Lenny. "Almost nobody knows, and you mustn't tell anyone." He lowered his voice, even though they were alone. "James's wife is a Catholic." Rollo was astounded. "Anne of Denmark, the Queen of Scotland, is a Catholic. But she was raised Protestant. God sent a devout man to speak to her, and she saw the light." "You mean someone converted her?" In a near whisper, Lenny said, "She has been received into the church." "God be praised. But this changes everything." Lenny raised a cautionary hand. "We don't think she'll be able to convert her husband." "Does he not love her?" "Hard to say. Our informants in Scotland say they're fond of one another, and they have three children. But they also say that James is a pervert." Rollo raised an inquiring eyebrow. "With young men," Lenny explained. "Men who loved men committed a cardinal sin, but many of them were priests," and Rollo was not shocked. Lenny went on, "James knows his wife has become a Catholic, and he's accepted the fact. If we can't expect that he'll restore England to exclusive Catholicism, perhaps we can hope for tolerance." Rollo winced at the word tolerance. For him, it was immorality, a mark of backsliding, error, and decadence. How could the Catholic Church now be demanding tolerance? Lenny did not notice. "We must move to exploit this situation, and that's where you come in. You must take a message to Edinburgh from the Catholic Church in England. If James will promise us freedom of worship, we will not oppose his bid for the English throne." Rollo saw immediately that this was the right thing to do, and his heart lifted in optimism. But there was a snag. "I'm not senior enough," he said. "The King of Scotland won't see me." "But the Queen will," said Lenny. "She's one of us now, so we can arrange it." "Is she so far committed?"
"Yes."
"That's wonderful," said Rollo. "I'll go, of course."
"Good man," said Lenny.
6 weeks later, Rollo was at the Palace of Holyrood in Edinburgh. The house stood at the foot of a hill called Arthur's Seat. To the west, the road ran for a mile to another hill, on which stood Edinburgh Castle, a much less comfortable home. King James and Queen Anne preferred to live at Holyrood. Rollo dressed in priest's robes and hung a crucifix around his neck. He went to the west range of the palace and gave the name Jean Langlais to an assistant, together with an appropriate bribe. He was shown to a pleasant small room with tall windows and a big fire. Scotland was not so bad, he thought, if you were rich. It would have been quite another matter in these cold winds to be one of the barefoot children he had seen in the town. An hour went by. Everyone knew that all royal servants pretended to be influential in order to solicit bribes, whether they had any real power or not. But Rollo was not relying only on his bribe. The priest who had converted Queen Anne to Catholicism was supposed also to tell her she should see Rollo. Nevertheless, she must first be told that Jean Langlais was here. The woman who came in was not the 27-year-old queen, but a gracious woman, past 60, who looked familiar.
"Welcome to Scotland, Father Langlais," she said. "Do you remember me? It's been almost 20 years.
When she spoke, he recognized her as Mary Stuart's long-time companion, Alison. Her hair was grey now, but she had the same alert blue eyes. He stood up and shook her hand.
"Lady Ross," he said. "I'm Lady Thurston now. I didn't expect to see you. Queen Anne has been very good to me."
Rollo got the picture. After the execution of Mary Stuart, Alison had returned to Scotland and married again. She had made herself useful to Queen Anne and become a lady-in-waiting. No doubt it was Alison who had introduced Anne to the Catholic priest who had converted her.
"I imagine it was you who suggested my mission today," Rollo said.
"Perhaps it was,"
Alison said. This was good news. It improved Rollo's chance of success.
"Thank you for your help."
"I owe you a great deal,"
Alison said warmly, and the thought crossed Rollo's mind that she might have a soft spot for him. But he had never been very interested in romance. Love was a passion that seemed to have passed him by. He was wondering how to respond to Alison when Queen Anne came in. She had a long, oval face with a high forehead and curly, light brown hair. Her figure was good, and she wore a dress with a low neckline to show off her generous bust.
"I'm very glad to see you, Father Langlais," she said pleasantly.
Rollo bowed low and said, "Your Majesty does me great honor." She corrected him.
"I do honor to the church you represent."
"Of course. Royal etiquette was maddeningly difficult. Forgive me.
But let's sit down and talk."
She took a seat herself, and Rollo and Alison followed suit. The Queen looked inquiringly at Rollo, waiting for him to open the conversation. Rollo got straight to the point. "His Holiness, Pope Clement, believes that your Majesty may soon be Queen of England."
"Of course," she said. "My husband's title to the English throne is indisputable."
It certainly was not indisputable. Mary Stuart had been executed as a traitor, and it was generally accepted that the children of traitors could not inherit titles. Rollo said tactfully, "And yet there may be men who oppose him." She nodded. She knew the facts. Rollo went on, "His Holiness has instructed English Catholics to support the claim of King James, provided only that he promises to allow us freedom of worship."
"His Majesty, my husband, is a man of tolerance," she said.
A grunt of disgust escaped Rollo at the loathed word tolerance, and he had to smother the noise with a cough. Queen Anne did not seem to notice.
"King James has accepted my conversion to the true faith," she went on.
"Wonderful,"
Rollo murmured.
"King James permits Catholic theologians at his court and often engages them in debate."
Rollo noticed Alison nodding discreetly to confirm this.
"I can assure you, without the least doubt," Queen Anne said firmly, "that when he becomes King of England, he will allow us Catholics freedom of worship."
"That gives me great joy,"
Rollo said with feeling. But in his mind, he heard Lenny Price say,
"But is it true?"
Rollo really needed to hear it from King James himself. Then the door opened, and James walked in. Rollo leaped to his feet and bowed low. King James was 36. He had the plump, fleshy face of a Sybarite, and his heavy-lidded eyes had a sly look. He kissed his wife's cheek fondly.
Queen Anne said to him, "Father Langlais here comes to tell us that His Holiness the Pope supports your claim to the throne of England."
James smiled at Rollo and spoke with a strong Scots accent.
"Thank you for bringing us this good news, Father."
He slobbered a little in his speech, as if his tongue might be too big for his mouth. Anne said,
"I have been assuring him that you would grant freedom of worship to English Catholics."
"Splendid,"
said the king. My mother was a Catholic, you know, Father Longley.
Requiescat in pace, said Rollo, using the Latin formulation of rest in peace that was favoured by Catholics.
Amen, said King James.
Ned Willard cried when Queen Elizabeth died. She passed away at Richmond Palace on March 24, 1603, in the early hours of a rainy Thursday. Ned was in the room, which was crowded with courtiers, clergymen, and ladies in waiting. A queen was too important to die in peace. Ned was 63. His two patrons, William Cecil and Francis Walsingham, had died years ago, but the monarch still had need of secret intelligence, and Ned had continued to provide it. At the deathbed, he stood next to Elizabeth's diminutive, hunchbacked Secretary of State, Robert Cecil, aged 40, younger son of the great William.
My pygmy,
Elizabeth had called Robert, with the casual cruelty of a monarch. But she had listened to him, for he was as brilliant as his father. Old William had said of his two sons, Thomas can hardly rule a tennis court, but Robert could rule England. We're all pygmies now, Ned thought sorrowfully. Elizabeth was the giant, and we just served her. Elizabeth had been in bed for 3 days, and unable to speak for most of that time. She had fallen asleep at about 10 last evening. Now it was 3 in the morning, and she had simply stopped breathing. Ned could not control his sobs. The woman who had dominated his life was gone. For the first time in years, he recalled the moment when he had glimpsed the young Princess Elizabeth getting out of her bath, and he was pierced by a pain that was almost physical, to think that the lovely girl he had seen then was now the lifeless husk that lay in the bed in front of him. Robert Cecil left the room the moment the doctors declared her dead, and Ned followed, wiping his wet face with the sleeve of his coat. They had no time to mourn. There was too much to do. They took a painfully slow barge to London in the darkness. Despite the royal ban on discussion of the succession, the council had agreed long ago that James of Scotland should be the next King of England. But it had to be done quickly. The ultra-Catholics knew the Queen was dying, and they, too, might have made elaborate plans. There was no plausible rival to James as king, but there were other ways for the succession to be disrupted. The likeliest scenario was that the ultras would try to kidnap James and his eldest son, Prince Henry. Then they would either kill James or force him to abdicate and declare the son king, which was how James himself had come to the throne of Scotland as a baby. Prince Henry was only 9 years old, so obviously an adult would have to rule as his regent, and that would, of course, be one of the senior Catholic noblemen, perhaps even Ned's stepson, Earl Bartlett of Shiring. Then the Protestants would form an army, civil war would break out, and England would see all the horror and bloodshed of the French Wars of Religion. Ned and Cecil had spent the last 3 months taking precautions against this dreadful scenario. Ned had made a list of the most powerful Catholics, and with Cecil's approval, had put them all in jail. An armed guard had been set about the Exchequer. Cannons had been test-fired at the Palace of Whitehall. Ned reflected that the three great women of the 16th century were now dead. Elizabeth, Queen Katharina of France, and Margarita of Parma, governor of the Netherlands. They had all tried to stop men killing one another over religion. Looking back, it seemed to him that their achievements had been pitifully limited. Evil men had always frustrated the efforts of the peacemakers. Bloody religious wars had raged for decades in France and the Netherlands. Only England had remained more or less at peace. All Ned wanted to do, with what remained of his life, was to keep that peace. Daylight dawned while they were still on the river. When they reached Whitehall, Cecil summoned the Privy Council. The council agreed a proclamation, and Robert Cecil wrote it out in his own hand. Then the councillors went out to the green opposite the tilt yard, where a crowd had gathered, no doubt having heard rumours. A herald read out the announcement that Elizabeth had died and James of Scotland was now king. After that, they rode to the city, where again crowds had gathered in places where proclamations were usually made. The herald read the statement outside St. Paul's Cathedral, then again at Cheapside Cross. Finally, the council went to the Tower of London and formally took possession of the fortress in the name of King James I of England. The reaction of Londoners was subdued, Ned observed with relief. Elizabeth had been popular, and they were sad. London merchants had prospered under Elizabeth, and their main wish was for no changes. James was an unknown quantity. A foreign king, though Scots was better than Spanish. A Protestant, but with a Catholic wife. A man, but rumoured to have womanly ways. Queen Elizabeth's funeral was held while James was still on the long journey from Edinburgh. 1,000 official mourners escorted the hearse on its short journey to Westminster Abbey, and Ned estimated that at least 100,000 people watched the procession. The coffin was covered in purple velvet and surmounted by a coloured wax model of Elizabeth in formal robes. Ned had a designated place in the cortege, but when they entered the cathedral, he was able to slip away and find Marjorie. He held her hand during the service and drew strength from her, like warmth from a fire. She was grieving too, for she had come to share Ned's conviction that peace between Christians was more important than doctrinal disputes, and Elizabeth had symbolized that life-saving creed. When the coffin was lowered into its grave in the Lady Chapel, Ned wept all over again. He considered what he was weeping for. It was partly for Elizabeth's idealism, which had also been his own. He grieved because those ideals had been so grubbily compromised over the years by the demands of everyday politics. For in the end, Elizabeth had put to death almost as many Catholics as Queen Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary, had killed Protestants. Mary had killed them for their beliefs, whereas Elizabeth had killed them for treason. But the line was too often blurred. Elizabeth was a flawed human being, and her reign had been a patchwork. All the same, Ned had admired her more than anyone else under heaven. Marjorie passed him a handkerchief for his tears. It was embroidered with a design of acorns, and he recognized it, with a little jolt of surprise, as one he had given her for the same purpose almost half a century ago. He wiped his face, but it was like trying to dry the beach at Coombe Harbour. The tears kept flowing with the relentlessness of the incoming tide. The chief officers of the royal household ritually snapped their white staves of office and threw the pieces into the grave after the coffin. As the congregation began to leave, it struck Ned that his life had been worth living because of the people who had loved him, and of those, the most important were four women, his mother, Alice, Queen Elizabeth, Sylvie, and Marjorie. Now he was stricken with grief because Elizabeth was the third of them to die, and he clung hard to Marjorie as they walked together away from the great cathedral, for he realized that she was all he had left. A year after the death of Queen Elizabeth, Rollo Fitzgerald swore that he would kill King James. James had broken his vows to Catholics. He had renewed Elizabeth's laws against Catholicism and had enforced them with extra savagery, as if he had never promised anyone tolerance or freedom of worship. Whether Queen Anne's undertakings had been sincere, Rollo would never know, but he suspected not. Together, James and Anne had duped Rollo and the community of English Catholics, and the Pope himself. Rollo's rage came from the knowledge that he had been fooled and had been used as the instrument of deceiving others. But he was not going to give in. He would not concede victory to the lying James and the spiteful Puritans, the blasphemers and the rebels against the true church. It was not over yet. The idea of shooting or stabbing James was hazardous. In getting close to the king, there was too much risk of being interfered with by guards or courtiers before the deed was done. On the roof of the tower at Tyne Castle, Rollo brooded over how the assassination could be managed, and as he did so, his lust for revenge sharpened, and his plan grew monstrously ambitious. How much better it would be to wipe out Queen Anne as well, and perhaps the royal children too, Henry, Elizabeth, and Charles, and the leading courtiers, especially Ned Willard. He wished he could shoot them all together with a double-shotted cannon as had been used against the Armada. He thought of the fireships, and wondered if he could set light to a palace when they were all gathered together. And slowly, a plan began to form in his mind. He travelled to Newcastle and put the plan to Earl Bartlett and the Earl's elder son, Swifty, 18. As a boy, Bartlett had hero-worshipped Rollo, and Rollo still had strong influence over him. Swifty had been told since he was old enough to talk that the fortunes of the Shiring earldom had shrunk under Elizabeth. Father and son were grievously disappointed that James was continuing Elizabeth's persecution of Catholics. Bartlett's younger brother, Roger, was not present. He worked in London for Robert Cecil and no longer lived at Newcastle, which was a good thing. Much influenced by his mother, Marjorie, and his stepfather, Ned Willard, Roger might have disapproved of Rollo's plan. "The opening of Parliament," Rollo said, when the servants had gone and the three men were alone after dinner. "We get them all together. King James, Queen Anne, Secretary of State Robert Cecil, Sir Ned Willard, and the members of that heretical, blaspheming Parliament. All dead with one fatal blow." Bartlett looked puzzled. "It's a tempting prospect, of course," he said, "but I can't imagine how it could possibly be achieved." "I can," said Rollo. Chapter 29. Ned Willard was on the alert, looking anxiously around the chapel, studying the wedding guests, watchful for danger signs. King James was expected to attend, and Ned was as afraid for James's life as he had been for Elizabeth's. The Secret Service could never relax its vigilance. It was 3 days after Christmas, 1604. Ned did not much like King James. The new king had turned out to be less tolerant than Elizabeth, and not just of Catholics. He had a bee in his bonnet about witches. He had written a book on the subject, and he had brought in harsh legislation against them. Ned thought they were mostly harmless old women. All the same, Ned was determined to protect James in order to prevent the civil war he dreaded. The bridegroom was Philip Herbert, the 20-year-old son of the Earl of Pembroke. Philip had caught the eye of King James in the embarrassing way that charming young men often took the fancy of the 38-year-old king. A court wit had said, "Elizabeth was king, now James is queen," and this wisecrack had been repeated all over London. James had encouraged young Philip to get married, as if to prove that his interest in the boy was innocent, which no one believed. The bride was Susan de Vere, granddaughter of the late William Cecil and niece of Secretary of State Robert Cecil, Ned's friend and colleague. Knowing that James was coming, bride and groom waited at the altar, for the king had to be the last to arrive. They were at a chapel within Whitehall Palace, where it would be all too easy for an assassin to strike. Ned was hearing rumours from his spies in Paris, Rome, Brussels, and Madrid. English Catholic exiles all over Europe were conspiring to get rid of King James, who, they felt, had betrayed them. But Ned had not yet learned the details of specific plots, so all he could do, for the time being, was keep his eyes open. If he had thought, when young, of what life would be like when he was 65, he would have assumed that his work would be done. Either he and Elizabeth would have succeeded, and England would be the first country in the world to have freedom of religion, or he would have failed, and Englishmen would again be burned at the stake for their beliefs. He had never anticipated that the struggle would still be as fierce as ever when he was old and Elizabeth was dead, that Parliament would still be persecuting Catholics, and that Catholics would still be trying to kill the monarch. Would it never end? He glanced at Marjorie beside him, a bright blue hat set at an angle on her silver curls. She met his eye and said, "What?" "I don't want the groom to see you," Ned murmured teasingly. "He may want to marry you instead of the bride." She giggled. "I'm an old lady." "You're the prettiest old lady in London." It was true. Ned looked around the room restlessly. He recognized most of those present. He had been intimate with the Cecils for almost half a century, and he knew the groom's family almost as well. Some of the younger people at the back were only vaguely familiar, and he guessed they were friends of the happy couple. Ned found it increasingly difficult, as the years went by, to tell one youngster from another. He and Marjorie were near the front, but Ned was not comfortable there, and kept looking over his shoulder. So, in the end, he left Marjorie and went to the back of the room. From there he could watch everyone, like a mother pigeon, studying the other birds, looking for the magpie that would eat her chicks. All the men wore swords, as a matter of course, so any one of them could have been an assassin in theory. This generalized suspicion was next to useless, and Ned racked his brains as to how he might learn more. The king and queen came in at last, safe and sound, and Ned was relieved to see that they were escorted by a dozen men-at-arms. An assassin would have trouble getting past such a bodyguard. Ned sat down and relaxed a little. The royal couple took their time walking up the aisle, greeting friends and favourites, and acknowledging the bows of others graciously. When they got to the front, James nodded to the clergyman to begin. While the service was going on, a new arrival slipped into the chapel, and Ned's instincts sounded an alarm. The newcomer stood at the back. Ned studied him, not caring whether the man knew he was being stared at. He was in his 30s, tall and broad, with something of the air of a soldier about him. However, he did not look stressed or even tense. He leaned against the wall, stroking his long moustache and watching the rite. He radiated arrogant confidence. Ned decided to speak to him. He got up and walked to the back. As he approached, the newcomer nodded casually and said, "Good day to you, Sir Ned. You know me. Everyone knows you, Sir Ned." The remark was a compliment with an undertone of mockery. "But I don't know you," Ned finished. "Fawkes," said the man. "Guy Fawkes, at your service. And who invited you here?" "I'm a friend of the groom, if it matters to you." A man who was about to kill a king would not be able to converse in this bantering manner. Nevertheless, Ned had a bad feeling about Fawkes. There was something about his coolness, his half-hidden disrespect, and his satirical tone that suggested subversive inclinations. Ned probed further. "I haven't met you before." "I come from York. My father was a proctor in the consistory court there." "Ah." A proctor was a lawyer, and a consistory court was a church tribunal. To hold such a post, Fawkes's father would have had to be an irreproachable Protestant and must have taken the oath of allegiance that Catholics abhorred. Fawkes was almost certainly harmless. All the same, as Ned returned to his seat, he decided to keep an eye on Guy Fawkes. Rollo Fitzgerald reconnoitred Westminster, looking for a weak spot. A collection of large and small buildings clustered around a court called Westminster Yard. Rollo was nervous about prowling around, but no one seemed to pay him much attention. The courtyard was a gloomy square where prostitutes loitered. No doubt other nefarious doings took place there after dark. The complex was walled and gated, but the gates were rarely closed even at night. Within the precincts were all the Parliament buildings, plus several taverns, a bakery, and a wine merchant with extensive cellars. The House of Lords, where the King would come to open Parliament, was a building on the plan of a squat letter H. The Grand Hall of the Lords, the biggest room, was the crossbar. One upright of the H was the Prince's Chamber, used as a robing room. The other was the Painted Chamber for committee meetings, but those three rooms were on the upstairs floor. Rollo was more interested in the ground floor rooms underneath. Beneath the Prince's Chamber was a porter's lodge and an apartment for the keeper of the King's wardrobe. Alongside ran a narrow passage, Parliament Place, leading to a wharf called Parliament Stairs on the left bank of the Thames. Rollo went to a nearby tavern called the Boatman and pretended to be a firewood dealer looking for storage space and willing to buy drinks for anyone who could give him information. There he gleaned two exciting nuggets. One, that the wardrobe keeper did not need his apartment and was willing to rent it out, and two, that it had a cellar. However, he was told, the place was reserved for courtiers and was not available to common tradesmen. Rollo looked crestfallen and said he would have to search elsewhere. The regulars at the bar thanked him for the drinks and wished him luck. Rollo had already recruited a co-conspirator, the courtier, Thomas Percy. As a Catholic, Percy would never be an adviser to the king, but James had made him one of the gentlemen pensioners, a group of ceremonial royal bodyguards. Percy's support was a mixed blessing, for he was a mercurial character, alternately full of manic energy or paralysed by gloom, not unlike his ancestor, Hotspur, in a popular play about the youth of Henry V. But now he proved useful. At Rollo's suggestion, Percy claimed he needed the wardrobe keeper's rooms for his wife to live in while he was at court, and, after a prolonged negotiation, he rented the apartment. That was a big step forward. Officially, Rollo was in London for a long, drawn-out lawsuit between the Earl of Tyne and a neighbour about the ownership of a watermill. This was a cover story. His real purpose was to kill the king. For that, He needed more men. Guy Fawkes was just the type he was looking for. Fawkes's staunchly Protestant father had died when little Guy was 8, and he had been raised by a Catholic mother and stepfather. As a wealthy young man, Fawkes had rejected a life of idleness, sold the estate he had inherited from his father, and set out to look for adventure. He had left England and fought for Spain against the Protestant rebels in the Netherlands, where he had learned about engineering during sieges. Now he was back in London at a loose end, ready for excitement. Unfortunately, Fawkes was under surveillance. This afternoon he was at the Globe Theatre, on the south side of the River Thames, watching a new play called Measure for Measure. Two places along the bench from him was Nick Bellows, an unobtrusive man in drab clothes, whom Rollo knew to be one of Ned Willard's street stalkers. Rollo was in the crowd of groundlings without seats. He followed the play with disapproval. Its story of a strong ruler who hypocritically breaks his own laws was blatantly designed to encourage disrespect for authority. Rollo was looking for an opportunity to speak to Fawkes without attracting the notice of Bellows, but it was proving difficult. Bellows discreetly followed when Fawkes left his seat, once to buy a cup of wine and once to piss in the river. Rollo still had not spoken to him when the play came to an end and the audience began to leave. The crowd choked the exit and the people shuffled along slowly. Rollo manoeuvred behind Fawkes and spoke in a low voice directly into his ear. "Don't look around, whatever you do. Just listen," he said. Perhaps Fawkes had been involved in clandestine activity before, for he did as Rollo said, only giving an almost imperceptible nod to show that he had understood. "His Holiness the Pope has work for you to do," Rollo said in the same low tone. "But you're being followed by one of King James's spies, so you first have to shake him off. Go to a tavern and drink a cup of wine to give me a chance to get ahead of you. Then walk west along the river, away from the bridge. Wait until there is only one boat at the beach, then hire it to take you across, leaving your tail behind. On the other side, walk quickly to Fleet Street and meet me at the York Tavern." Fawkes nodded again once. Rollo moved away. He went over London Bridge and walked briskly through the city and beyond its walls to Fleet Street. He stood across the street from the York, wondering whether Fawkes would come. He guessed that Fawkes would be unable to resist the call of adventure, and he was right. Fawkes appeared, walking with the characteristic swagger that made Rollo think of a prize fighter. Rollo watched another minute or two, but neither Bellows nor anyone else was following. He went inside. Fawkes was in a corner with a jug of wine and two goblets. Rollo sat opposite, with his back to the room. Hiding his face was now an ingrained habit. Fawkes said, "Who was following me?" "Nick Bellows, small man in a brown coat, sitting next but two to you. I didn't notice him. He goes to a certain amount of trouble not to be noticed." "Of course. What do you want with me?" "I have a simple question for you," Rollo said. "Do you have the courage to kill the king?" Fawkes looked at him hard, weighing him up. His stare would have intimidated many men, but Rollo was his equal in self-regard and stared right back. At last, Fawkes said, "Yes." Rollo nodded, satisfied. This was the kind of plain speaking he wanted. "You've been a soldier. You understand discipline," he said. Again, Fawkes just said, "Yes. Your new name is John Johnson. Isn't that a bit obvious? Don't argue. You're going to be the caretaker of a small apartment that we've rented. I'll take you there now. You can't go back to your lodging. It may be watched. There's a pair of pistols in my room that I'd be sorry to leave behind. I'll send someone to collect your belongings when I'm sure the coast is clear. All right? We should go now." "Where is this apartment?"
"At Westminster," said Rollo. "In the House of Lords."
It was already dark on a rainy evening, but the London taverns and shops were lit up with lanterns and blazing torches, and Marjorie knew she was not mistaken when she saw her brother across the street. He was standing outside a tavern called the White Swan, apparently saying goodbye to a tall man whom Marjorie thought she recognized. Marjorie had not seen her brother for years. That suited her. She did not like to be reminded of the fact that he was Jean Langlais. Because of this terrible secret,
She had almost turned down Ned's proposal of marriage 15 years ago. But if she had done so, she would never have been able to tell him why. She loved him so much, but in the end what tipped the balance was not her love for him, but his for her. He longed for her, she knew, and if she had turned him down, without plausible explanation, he would have spent the rest of his life being mystified and wounded. She had power over his life, and she was unable to resist the temptation to make him happy. She could not be comfortable with her secret, but it was like the backache that had afflicted her ever since the birth of Roger. It never ceased to hurt, but she learned to live with it. She crossed the street. As she did so, the second man left, and Rollo turned to go back into the tavern. "Rollo," she said. He stopped suddenly at the door, startled, and for a moment he looked so fearful that she felt concerned. Then he recognized her.
"It's you,"
he said warily.
"I didn't know you were in London," she said. "Wasn't that Thomas Percy you were talking to?"
"Yes, it was."
"I thought so. I recognized his prematurely grey hair."
Marjorie did not know what religion Percy adhered to, but some of his famous family were Catholic, and Marjorie was suspicious.
"You're not up to your old tricks, are you, Rollo?"
"Certainly not. All that is over."
"I hope so."
Marjorie was not fully reassured.
"So what are you doing here?"
"I'm handling a protracted lawsuit for the Earl of Tyne. He's in dispute with a neighbour over the ownership of a watermill." That was true, Marjorie knew. Her son Roger had mentioned it. "Roger says the legal fees and bribes have already cost more than 3 watermills. "My clever nephew is right, but the Earl is obstinate. Come inside." They went in and sat down. A man with a big red nose brought Rollo a cup of wine without asking. His proprietorial air suggested to Marjorie that he was the landlord. Rollo said, "Thank you, Hodgkinson."
"Something for the lady?"
the man asked.
"A small glass of ale, please,"
Marjorie said. Hodgkinson went away, and Marjorie said to Rollo,
"Are you lodging here?"
"Yes." She was puzzled.
"Doesn't the Earl of Tyne have a London house?"
"No, he just rents one when Parliament is sitting."
"You should use Shiring House. Bartlett would be happy for you to stay there."
"There are no servants there, just a janitor, except when Bartlett comes to London."
"Bartlett would gladly send a couple of people up here from Newcastle to look after you if you asked him."
Rollo looked peeved. "Then they would spend his money on beef and wine for themselves and feed me bacon and beer, and if I complained, they'd tell Bartlett I was too high-handed and demanding. Frankly, I prefer a tavern." Marjorie was not sure whether he was irritated by her or by the thought of dishonest servants, but she decided to drop the question. If he wanted to stay in a tavern, he could.
"How are you, anyway?"
she said. "The same as ever. The Earl of Tyne is a good master. How about you? Is Ned well?"
"He's in Paris right now."
"Really?" said Rollo, interested. "What's he doing there?"
"His work," she said vaguely. "I'm not really sure."
Rollo knew she was lying. "Spying on Catholics, I assume. That's his work, as everyone knows."
"Come on, Rollo, it's your fault for trying to murder his queen. Don't pretend to be indignant."
"Are you happy with Ned?"
"Yes.
God, in his wisdom, has given me a strange life, but for the last 15 years I have been truly happy." She noticed that his shoes and stockings were covered with mud.
"How on earth did you get so dirty?"
"I had to walk along the foreshore."
"Why?"
"Long story, and I have an appointment." Rollo stood up. Marjorie realized she was being dismissed. She kissed her brother's cheek and left. She had not asked him what his appointment was about, and as she walked away from the tavern, she asked herself why. The answer came immediately. She did not think he would tell her the truth. Rollo imposed strict security at the wardrobe keeper's apartment. Everyone arrived before dawn, so that they would not be seen entering. Each man brought his own food, and they did not go outside in daylight. They left again after dark. Rollo was almost 70, so he left the harder work to younger men such as Fawkes and Percy, but even they struggled. All were the sons of noble and wealthy families, and none of them had previously done much digging. They had first to demolish the brick wall of the cellar, then scoop out the earth behind it.
The tunnel needed to be large enough for a number of 32-gallon barrels of gunpowder to be dragged inside. They saved time by making it no larger, but the disadvantage of that was that they had to work bent double or lying down, and the confined space grew hot. During the day they lived on salted fish, dried meat, and raisins. Rollo would not let them send out for the kind of meal they were used to, for fear they would draw attention to themselves. It was muddy work, which was why Rollo had been embarrassingly dirty when he unexpectedly ran into Marjorie. The soil they removed from the tunnel had to be lugged up to ground level, then taken outside after dark, and carried along Parliament Passage and down Parliament Stairs, from where it could be thrown into the river. Rollo had been unnerved when Marjorie asked about his filthy stockings, but she had seemed to accept his explanation. The tunnelers were discreet, but not invisible. Even in the dark, they were sometimes seen coming and going by people carrying lanterns. To divert suspicion, Fawkes had let it be known that he had builders in, making some alterations that his master's wife had demanded. Rollo hoped no one would notice the improbably large quantity of earth being displaced by mere alterations. Then they ran into a difficulty so serious that Rollo was afraid it might ruin the whole plan. When they had tunneled into the earth for several feet, they came up against a solid stone wall. Naturally, Rollo realized, the two-story building above had proper foundations. He should have anticipated this. The work became harder and slower, but they had to go on, for they were not yet far enough under the debating chamber to be sure that the explosion would kill everyone there. The stone foundations turned out to be several feet thick. Rollo feared they would not finish the job before the opening ceremony. Then Parliament was postponed because of an outbreak of plague in London, and the tunnellers had a new deadline. Even so, Rollo fretted. Progress was terribly slow. The longer they took, the more risk there was that they would be discovered. And there was another hazard. As they went farther, undermining the foundations, Rollo feared a collapse. Fawkes made stout timber props to support the roof, as he said he had done when digging under city walls in Netherlands sieges, but Rollo was not sure how much this fighting man really knew about mining. The tunnel might just fall in and kill them all. It could even bring down the entire building, which would achieve nothing if the king were not inside. Taking a break one day, they talked about who would be in the chamber when the gunpowder went off. King James had 3 children, Prince Henry, 11, and Prince Charles, 4, would probably accompany their parents to the ceremony. "Assuming they both die, Princess Elizabeth will be the heir," said Percy. "She will be 9. Rollo had already thought about the princess. "We must be prepared to seize her," he said. "Whoever has her has the throne." Percy said, "She lives at Coombe Abbey in Warwickshire. She will need a Lord Protector, who will of course be the actual ruler of England. I propose my kinsman, the Earl of Northumberland." Rollo nodded. It was a good suggestion. Northumberland was one of the great peers of the realm and a Catholic sympathizer. But Rollo had a better idea. "I suggest the Earl of Shiren." The others were not enthusiastic. Rollo knew what they were thinking. Bartlett Charing was a good Catholic, but did not have Northumberland's stature. Too polite to denigrate Rollo's nephew, Percy said, "We must plan uprisings in all parts of the country where Catholic peers are strong. There must be no opportunity for the Protestants to promote a rival for the throne." "I can guarantee that in the county of Shiring," said Rollo. Someone said, "Lots of people will die." Rollo was impatient with men who worried about killing. A civil war would be a cleansing. "The Protestants deserve death," he said, "and the Catholics will go straight to heaven." Just then there was a strange noise. At first it sounded like a rush of water overhead. Then it turned into a rumble, as of shifting rocks. Rollo immediately feared a collapse. The other men clearly had the same instinctive reaction, for they all rushed, as if to save their lives, up the narrow stone staircase that led from the cellar to the apartment at ground level. There they stopped and listened. The noise continued intermittently, but the floor was not shaking, and Rollo realized they had overreacted. The building was not about to fall down. But what was happening? Rollo pointed at Fawkes. "Come with me," he said. "We'll investigate. The rest of you, stay quiet." He led Fawkes outside and around the building. The noise had stopped, but Rollo thought it must have come from roughly where their tunnel ran. At the back of the building, a row of windows ran along the upper story, lighting the debating chamber. In the middle of the row was a small door, opening onto a wooden exterior staircase. It was not much used, for the grand entrance was on the other side. Under the staircase, at ground level, was a double wooden door that Rollo had hardly noticed before. If he had thought about it, he would have assumed that it gave access to the kind of storeroom where gardeners kept spades. Now, for the first time, he saw both doors wide open. A cart horse stood patiently outside. Rollo and Fawkes stepped through the doorway. It was a store, but it was huge. In fact, Rollo guessed, it was probably the same length and width as the debating chamber directly above. He was not quite sure, because the windowless vault was dark, illuminated mainly by the light coming through the doorway. From what he could see, it looked like the crypt of a church, with massive pillars curving up to a low wooden ceiling that must have formed the floor of the room above. Rollo realized, with dismay, that the tunnelers had probably been hacking through the base of one of those pillars. They were in even more danger of collapse than he had feared. The room was mostly empty, with odd pieces of timber and sacking lying around, and a square table with a hole broken through its top. Rollo immediately saw the explanation for the noise. A man, whose face was black with dust, was shoveling coal from a pile onto a cart. That was the cause of the noise. Rollo glanced at Fawkes, and knew they were both thinking the same thing. If they could get control of this room, they could place their gunpowder even nearer to the king, and they could stop tunneling. A woman of middle age was watching the carter work. When his vehicle was loaded, he counted coins with his sooty hands and gave them to her, evidently paying her for the coal. She took the coins to the doorway to examine them in the light before thanking the man. Then, as the carter backed his horse into the shafts of the cart, the woman turned to Rollo and Fawkes and said politely, "Good night, you gentlemen. Is there something I can do for you?" "What is this room?" Rollo asked. "I believe it used to be the kitchen, in the days when banquets were served in the grand chamber above. Now it's my coal store, or it was. Spring is coming and I'm getting rid of my stocks. You may like to buy some. It's the best hard coal from the banks of the River Tyne. Burns really hot." Fawkes interrupted her. "We don't want coal, but we're looking for somewhere to store a large quantity of wood. My name is John Johnson. I'm caretaker of the wardrobe keeper's apartment."
"I'm Ellen Skinner, widow and coal merchant."
"I'm pleased to make your acquaintance, Mrs. Skinner. Is this place available to rent?"
"I've got it leased for the rest of the year."
"But you're getting rid of your stock, you say, because spring is coming. Few people buy coal in warm weather." She looked crafty.
"I may have another use for the place."
She was feigning reluctance, but Rollo could see the light of greed in her eyes. Her arguments were no more than negotiating tactics. He began to feel hopeful. Fawkes said, "My master would pay well."
"I'd give up my lease for £3, she said, "and you'd have to pay the landlord on top of that. £4 a year he charges me."
Rollo suppressed the impulse to say eagerly, "It's a bargain." The price did not matter, but if they were seen to be throwing money around, they would attract attention and perhaps suspicion. Fawkes haggled for the sake of appearance. "Oh, madam, that seems too much," he said. "A pound for your lease at most, surely."
"I might keep the place. I'll need a coal store come September."
"Split the difference," Fawkes said. £1.10.
"If you could make it £2, I'd shake hands on it now."
"Oh, very well," Fawkes said, and held out his hand.
"A pleasure, Mr. Johnson," said the woman.
Fawkes said, "I assure you, Mrs. Skinner, the pleasure is all mine." Ned went to Paris in a desperate attempt to find out what was happening in London. He continued to hear vague rumours of Catholic plots against King James, and his suspicion had been heightened when Guy Fawkes deftly shook off his surveillance and disappeared. But there was a frustrating lack of detail in the gossip. Many royal assassination plots had been hatched in Paris, often with the help of the ultra-Catholic Guise family. The Protestants there had maintained the network of spies Sylvie had set up. Ned hoped that one of them, most likely Alain de Guise, might be able to fill the gaps. After the simultaneous murders of Duke Henri and Pierre Romande, Ned had feared that Alain would no longer be a source of information on exiled English Catholics.
but Alain had picked up some of his stepfather's wiliness. He had made himself useful to the widow, and befriended the new young duke, and so continued to live at the Guise palace in Paris and work for the family. And because the ultra-Catholic Guises were trusted by the English plotters, Alain learned a good deal about their plans and passed the information to Ned by coded letters, sent along well-established secret channels. Much of the exile's talk came to nothing, but several times over the years, Alain's tips had led to arrests. Ned read all his letters, but now he was hoping to learn more by a personal visit. In face-to-face conversation, random details could sometimes emerge and turn out to be important. Worried though he was, the trip to France was nostalgic for him. It put him in mind of himself as a young man, of the great Walsingham, with whom he had worked for 2 decades, and most of all, of Sylvie. On his way to meet Alain, he went to the Rue de la Serpente and stood for a while outside the bookshop that had been Sylvie's home, remembering the happy day he had been invited to dinner there and had kissed her in the back room, and the terrible day Isabel had been killed there. It was a butcher's shop now. He crossed the bridge to the Ile de la Cité, went into the cathedral, and said a prayer of thanks for Sylvie's life. The church was Catholic, and Ned was Protestant, but he had long believed that God cared little about such distinctions. And nowadays the King of France felt the same. Henri IV had signed the Edict of Nantes, giving Protestants religious freedom. The new Duke of Guise was still a child, and the Guise family had not been able to undermine the peace this time, and so 40 years of civil war had come to an end. Ned thanked God for Henry IV, too. Perhaps France, like England, was slowly fumbling its way toward tolerance. Protestant services were still discreet, and usually held outside the walls of cities to avoid inflaming ultra-Catholics. Ned walked south along the Rue Saint-Jacques, through the city gate, and out into the suburbs. A man sitting reading at the roadside was the signpost to a track that led through the woods to a hunting lodge. This was the informal church Sylvie had attended before Ned met her. It had been exposed by Pierre Aumond, and the congregation had broken up, but now it was again a place of worship. Alain was already there, sitting with his wife and children. Also with him was his longtime friend Louise, the Dowager Marchioness of Nîmes. Both had been at the Chateau of Blois when Duke Henri and Pierre had been murdered, and Ned suspected they had been in on the plot, though no one had dared to investigate either killing because of the presumed involvement of the king. Ned also saw Nath, who had taken over Sylvie's business in illegal books. She had become a prosperous old lady in a fur hat. Ned sat next to Alain, but did not speak until the hymns, when everyone was singing too loudly to hear their talk. "They all hate this James," Alain murmured to Ned, speaking French. "They say he broke his promises." "They're not wrong," Ned admitted. "All the same, I have to stop them killing him. Otherwise the peace and prosperity that Elizabeth won with such a tremendous effort will be shattered by civil war." "What else do you hear?" "They want to kill the entire royal family, all but the little princess, whom they will declare queen." "The entire family?" Ned repeated, horrified. "Bloodthirsty brutes. At the same time, they will kill all the leading ministers and lords." "They must plan to burn down a palace or something. They could do that while everyone was sitting at a banquet or watching a play." He was one of the leading ministers. Suddenly this had become about saving his own life, as well as the king's. He felt a chill. "Where will they do it?" he asked. "I have not been able to elucidate that point." "Have you ever heard the name Guy Fawkes?" Alain shook his head. "No. A group came to see the Duke, but I don't know who they were." "No names were mentioned." "No real names." "What do you mean?" "The only name I heard was a false one."
"And what was that?"
"Jean Langley," said Alain. Marjorie was bothered about Rollo. His answers to her questions had all been plausible, but just the same, she did not trust him. However, she did not see what she could do about her unease. Of course, she could have told Ned that Rollo was Jean Langley, but she could not bring herself to condemn her brother to the gallows just because he had muddy stockings. While Ned was in Paris, Marjorie decided to take her grandson Jack, the son of Roger, on a visit to Newcastle. She felt it was her duty.
Whatever Jack ended up doing with his life, he could be helped by his aristocratic relations. He did not have to like them, but he had to know them. Having an earl for an uncle was sometimes better than money. And when Bartlett died, the next earl would be his son Swifty, who was Jack's cousin. Jack was an inquiring, argumentative 12-year-old. He entered energetically into disputatious conversations with Roger and with Ned, always taking the view opposite to that of the adult he was talking to. Ned said that Jack was exactly like the young Marjorie, but she could hardly believe she had been so cocky. Jack was small, like Marjorie, with the same curly dark hair. He was pretty now, but in a year or two he would begin to turn into a man, and then his looks would coarsen. The pleasure and fascination of watching children and grandchildren grow and alter was the great joy of being elderly for Marjorie. Naturally, Jack disagreed with his grandmother about the need for this visit. "I want to be an adventurer like Uncle Barney," he said. "Noblemen have nothing to do with trade. They just sit back and collect rents from people." "The nobility keep the peace and enforce the rules," she argued. "You can't do business without laws and standards. How much silver is there in a penny? How wide is a yard of cloth? What happens when men don't pay their debts?" "They make the rules to suit themselves," said Jack. "Anyway, the Kingsbridge Guild enforces weights and measures, not the Earl." She smiled. "Perhaps you should be a statesman, like Sir Ned, rather than an adventurer." "Why?" "You have such strong ideas about government. You could be the government. Some of the most powerful men at court used to be clever schoolboys, like you." He looked thoughtful. He was at the delightful age where anything seemed possible. But she wanted him to behave himself at Newcastle. "Be polite," she said as they approached. "Don't argue with Uncle Bartlett. You're here to make friends, not enemies."
"Very well, grandmother."
She was not sure he had taken her warning to heart, but she had done her best. A child will always be what he is, she thought, and not what you want him to be. Her son, Earl Bartlett, welcomed them. In his 40s now, he was freckled like Marjorie's father, but he had modelled himself on Bart, who he thought was his father. The fact that Bartlett was, in truth, the result of rape by Earl Swithin had not completely poisoned the relationship between mother and son, miraculously. While Jack explored the castle, Marjorie sat in the hall with Bartlett and drank a glass of wine. She said, "I hope Swifty and Jack get to know one another better."
"I doubt they'll be close," said Bartlett. 12 to 20 is a big age gap.
"I bumped into your Uncle Rollo in London. He's staying in a tavern. I don't know why he doesn't use Shiring House."
Bartlett shrugged. "I'd be delighted if he would. Make my lazy caretaker do some work for a change."
A steward poured Marjorie more wine.
"You'll be heading up to London yourself later this year for the opening of Parliament."
"Not necessarily."
Marjorie was surprised.
"Why not?"
"I'll say I'm ill."
All earls were obliged to attend Parliament, and if they wanted to get out of it, they had to say they were too ill to travel.
"But what's the real reason?"
"I've got too much to do here."
That did not make sense to Marjorie.
"You've never missed a Parliament since you became Earl, nor did your father and grandfather. It's the reason you have a house in London. The new king has no interest in the views of the Earl of Shiring."
This was uncharacteristic. Bartlett, like Bart and Swithin, would normally voice his opinion loudly, without asking whether anyone cared to hear it.
"Don't you want to oppose any further anti-Catholic legislation?"
"I think we've lost that battle."
"I've never known you to be so defeatist. It's important to know when to fight on and when to stop."
Bartlett stood up.
"You probably want to settle into your room before dinner. Have you got everything you need?"
"Yes, I think so."
She kissed him and went upstairs. She was intrigued. Maybe he was not like Bart and Swithin after all. Their pride would never have allowed them to say things like,
"I think we've lost that battle."
They would never have admitted that they might be in the wrong. Perhaps Bartlett was growing up. The most difficult and dangerous part of Rollo's plan came when he had to buy 36 barrels of gunpowder and bring them to Westminster. With two of his younger conspirators, he crossed the river and walked to Rotherhithe, a neighbourhood of docks and shipyards. There they went to a stable and told an ostler that they wanted to rent a sturdy flatbed cart and two horses to pull it.
We have to pick up a load of timbers from a demolished old ship, Rollo said. I'm going to use them to build a barn. Ship's timbers were often recycled this way. The ostler was not interested in Rollo's story. He showed Rollo a cart and two sturdy horses, and Rollo said, Fine, that's just what I need. Then the ostler said, My man Weston will drive you. Rollo frowned. He could not accept this. A driver would witness everything. I'd rather drive myself, he said, trying not to sound agitated. I have two helpers. The ostler shook his head. If Weston doesn't go with you, you'll have to pay a deposit. Otherwise, add to one now you'll bring the cart back. How much? Rollo asked for the sake of appearances. He was willing to pay more or less anything. £5 for each of the horses and £1 for the cart. You'll have to give me a receipt. When the transaction was finalized, they drove out of the stable yard and went to a firewood supplier called Pierce. There, Rollo bought faggots, irregular branches tied in bundles, and billets, which were more regular split logs, also roped together. They loaded all the wood onto the cart. Pierce was curious about Rollo's insistence on meticulously stacking the bundles on the cart in the shape of a hollow square, leaving an empty space in the middle. You must be picking up another load that you want to keep hidden, he said. Nothing valuable, said Rollo, as if he were afraid of thieves. Pierce tapped the side of his nose knowingly. Enough said. They drove the cart to Greenwich, where Rollo had a rendezvous with Captain Ratcliffe. Guy Fawkes had calculated the amount of gunpowder required to be sure of completely destroying the House of Lords and killing everyone in it. A gentleman who owned a pistol or an arquebus might buy a box of gunpowder for his own use, and no one would ask any questions, but there was no legitimate way for Rollo to buy the quantity he needed without arousing suspicion. His solution was to go to a criminal. Ratcliffe was a corrupt quartermaster who bought supplies for the Royal Navy. Half of what he purchased never went on board a ship, but was privately resold by him to line his own pockets. Ratcliffe's biggest problem was hiding how rich he was. The good thing about him, from Rollo's point of view, was that he could not babble about the sale of gunpowder, for if he did, he would be hanged for stealing from the king. He had to keep silent, for the sake of his own life. Rollo met Ratcliffe in the yard of a tavern. They loaded 8 barrels on the cart, stacking them too high in the middle of the square of firewood. A casual observer would assume the barrels contained ale.
You must be expecting a war, said Ratcliffe.
Rollo had an answer ready.
We're merchant sailors, he said. We need to defend ourselves. Indeed you do, said Ratcliffe. We're not pirates.
No, said Ratcliffe. Of course not.
Like Pierce, Ratcliffe was inclined to believe whatever Rollo denied. When they were done, they completed the square and added wood on top, so that the secret load could not be seen even from a high window. Then Rollo drove the cart back to Westminster. He went carefully. Crashes between wheeled vehicles were commonplace, usually leading to fistfights between the drivers, which sometimes escalated to street riots. The London crowd, never slow to seize an opportunity, would often rob the carts of their loads while the drivers were distracted. If that happened to him, the game would be up. He drove so cautiously, always allowing another cart to go first, that other drivers began to look suspiciously at him. He made it back to Westminster Yard without incident. Fawkes was waiting and opened the double doors as they approached, so that Rollo was able to drive the cart into the storeroom without stopping. Fawkes closed the doors behind the cart, and Rollo slumped with relief. He had got away with it. He only had to do the same thing 3 more times. Fawkes pointed to a new door in the wall, dimly visible by the light of a lamp. I made a passage from here to the wardrobe keeper's apartment, he said. Now we can go from one to the other without stepping outside and risking being seen.
Very good, said Rollo.
What about the cellar? I've bricked up the tunnel.
Show me.
The two men went through the new doorway into the apartment, then down the stairs to the cellar. Fawkes had filled in the hole they had made in the wall, but the repair was visible even by candlelight.
Get some mud or soot and dirty the new bricks, Rollo said, and maybe hack at them a bit with a pickaxe, so that they look as if they've been damaged over the years.
Good idea. I want that patch of wall to be indistinguishable from all the rest.
Of course.
But no one is going to come down here anyway. Just in case, said Rollo, we can't be too careful. They returned to the storeroom. The other two were unloading the gunpowder barrels and rolling them to the far end of the space. Rollo directed them to put the firewood in front of the barrels, stacking the bundles carefully so that the pile would remain stable. One of the young men stood on the broken table, careful not to put his foot through the hole, and the other passed bundles up to him to be placed at the top. When it was done, Rollo studied their work carefully. No one would suspect that this was anything other than a stack of firewood. He was satisfied. Even if someone were to search this place, he said with satisfaction, they probably wouldn't find the gunpowder. Ned and Marjorie lived in St. Paul's Churchyard, in a pleasant row house with a pear tree in the backyard. It was not grand, but Marjorie had made it cosy with rugs and pictures, and they had coal fires to keep the place warm in winter. Ned liked it because he could look out and see the cathedral, which reminded him of Kingsbridge. Ned arrived back from Paris late one evening,